and tonight to share experience, strength, and hope with us from Bohemia Zed.
Wow. Good evening, everybody. My name's Eddie. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober tonight by the grace of a power I call God. And it was a power I was completely asleep to before I experienced the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I mean when I say that is I don't keep me sober. It's not my job. I'm really bad at it. I tried that for a long time. The belief that I could keep myself sober almost killed me. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and originally I met some people who seemed to be able to keep themselves sober. I'm always fascinated by those people. Not that they can keep themselves sober, because lots of people can do that. Why they come to Alcoholics Anonymous is the part that fascinates me. Because I couldn't keep myself sober. And I tried. And for years of trying, after years of trying, I had screwed up my life pretty bad. I did all the usual things, wrecked cars and lost relationships and ruined jobs, and I was in business for myself for a while, lost a lot of customers, and screwed that stuff up pretty bad. And very frequently, I would say, I'd have that thought that sometimes we have, say, God, this has got to stop. This has got to stop. And then I would stop. So it wasn't any great epiphany for me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I needed to stop drinking. I knew that. Matter of fact, I knew that alcohol was ruining my life by the time I was probably 17 or 18. I'd already wrecked my first car. And the funny thing was, knowing that alcohol was killing me, knowing that it was ruining my life, seemed to have very little effect on me. Knowing that I should not drink did not stop me from drinking. Sometimes I'll hear in Alcoholics Anonymous somebody say, well, once I knew it was the alcohol that was my problem, I just stopped. And I'm amused by those people too. Because if knowing alcohol was my problem was sufficient to stop me, I wouldn't have come here. But knowing, see, I always believed that. Well, if I just wanted to stop bad enough, it just didn't work for me. And by the end of my drinking, I was drinking about a quart of vodka a day. I say about a quart of vodka because I don't know, I never measured it, but I was buying one of those 1.75 liter jugs of Georgie in the plastic squeeze bottle. They come out a little faster that way. And nothing but the good stuff. And I would finish one of them every 2 days. And I was taking these sleeping pills, these Ambiens, not always at night, sometimes in the middle of the day, to go with the vodka, which is a guaranteed blackout. Ambien's one of those drugs. They recently had this warning on TV. You know, they had this, all these news stories about people who were taking them and then wake up the next morning with all these bags of fast food in their car. They don't remember how they got them. Because the drug is designed to cause a blackout. And when you mix it with vodka, it's a guaranteed blackout. I don't know if it puts you to sleep or not. It really doesn't matter because you won't remember. And in that sense, I suppose it's very effective. So, and I'd awake many mornings and I'd say that, God, no. This has got to, not today. I am absolutely not drinking today. And I absolutely meant I was not drinking today. And then around 12 or 1 o'clock, I would think, well, maybe that was a little rash. Maybe I could have one or two. And, you know, by the end of the day, I'd finish the day the same way, and I'd wake up the next morning and say the same thing. And I really believed it. A lot of times people say, no, you really didn't mean it. You really didn't believe it. I had the privilege some 16 years ago of being polygraphed to become a Suffolk County police officer out in Suffolk County. They polygraph you. And they asked me this question. I'll never forget. It was one of those mornings I woke up and I decided I'm never drinking again. And so the guy in the polygraph said to me, do you have a problem with alcohol? And in my mind, I thought, no, I'm never drinking again. So I said no. And I passed. Passed that lie detector test. Anyone here guess what I was doing at 6 o'clock that night? Yeah, I was drinking. So I believed it. I just didn't have the power to pull that off. But I had no idea what that meant. Finally, I drove home from Albany, New York, and I don't know if I'll ever forget this story, but the scary part about not being able to forget this story is that what I know today about alcoholism and for my own life is that remembering this story won't keep me sober. That I may remember it right now to share it with you, but certainly that won't keep me from drinking, because I had hundreds of stories just like this. But I drove home from Albany, New York. It was one of those thousands of days that I had said over the years that I was not going to drink today, Well, I had to drive back from Albany, and I thought maybe that's not a good idea. And then up there, somebody said, why don't you have a glass of wine? And I thought, no, not right now. And then I waited about, you know, a minute and a half. And I said, all right, well, I'll have one. And I don't remember how many I had, but I know that I left there, and I didn't. As I was pulling in my driveway some 5 hours later, I looked in the rearview mirror, and I saw my two little kids in the back seat. And I thought to myself, my God, I could have killed these kids. This has got to stop. And the only problem was, by that point, I had probably said this thousands of times. And I meant it every time, and I didn't know how to pull that off. So 2 days later, I got a call from my identical twin brother. I have an identical twin brother. We're genetically identical. He's alcoholic just like me. Turns out that alcoholism seems to be genetic in nature. What that means to me is I don't have brown hair because I had a bad childhood. I have brown hair because genetically I have brown hair. I don't have alcoholism because my mother didn't love me enough. I have alcoholism because genetically there's something wrong with me. But I didn't understand that at the time. But my identical twin brother was also alcoholic, so that's a pretty good clue. And unlike me, he was a multi-million-dollar-a-year attorney. He was making some big money down in Dallas. He was making about $2 million a year. And he wasn't drinking Georgie out of the squeeze bottle. He was drinking Johnny Walker Blue. And I didn't even know it came in blue. I knew about Johnny Walker Red. I couldn't really afford that. I knew about Johnny Walker Black. I could never afford that. I didn't know it came in blue. Who knew? And well, he had a reputation to uphold. But he had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said to me, you know, you need to do something about your drinking. Like, no kidding? I said, I have. He said, what's that? I said, I'm not drinking anymore. He asked me this question. Maybe some of you can relate to it. He said, how's that working out for you? Now, wait a minute. I just told him I'm not drinking anymore. That should be working out good, right? Because sometimes I think that I'm supposed to believe that, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and people share that way. Well, I haven't had a drink in 3 weeks. Everything's wonderful. Really? So when he asked me, how's that working out for you? It wasn't. And I was really honest. It wasn't. In our big book over here, on page 151, there's a little thing on the bottom. It says, now and then a serious drinker being dry at the moment says, and these are some of the things serious drinkers who aren't drinking right now say. I don't miss it at all. Feel better. Work better. Having a better time. I think, no, that wasn't my experience. But then if you read on, it says, as ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. Now, the book was written a long time ago, and so that language is a little, smile at such a sally? We just laugh at that nonsense. What do we laugh at? We laugh at the guy who says, don't miss it at all, feel better, work better, having a better time. Why would we laugh at him? It goes on to say, our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark. Whistling, and I think like a little cartoon movie, you know, bug eyes in the windows, dark streets. Terrified. That would be a boy whistling in the dark. So he fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take a half a dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again. And here comes some honesty. For he isn't happy about his sobriety. Unhappy about my sobriety? How could that be? But you see, I didn't understand what it meant to be alcoholic. And I really thought alcohol was my problem. But it was really clear to me that morning that alcohol wasn't my problem because I wasn't drinking and it wasn't working out. So he said something about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, no, thank you. And I hung up. And about a week later, he called me back. He said, how's that not drinking thing going? I said, well, I haven't had a drink in a week, and it's getting worse. Anybody know what I mean? It's getting worse. What's getting worse? Well, not out there. Out there is kind of like probably getting better. But that's irrelevant to me. It's getting worse behind my eyeballs. I can hardly get out of bed. I'm so full of fear. I don't know what to do with myself during the day. I'm angry at everybody. I'm depressed to the point where I'm thinking, like, I just can't do this anymore. And he says, why don't you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, Alcoholics Anonymous? Please. I'm not doing that. I've seen you people on TV. They made fun of you on, like, sitcoms. Hi, I'm Bob, I'm alcoholic, blah, blah. I'm not doing that. I said, what are they going to do for me? He said, well, they got these 12 steps, and they got this book, which contains the directions for the 12 steps. They call it the Big Book, and those instructions will show you how to work those 12 steps, and those 12 steps will show you how to live sober. And I said, yeah, thanks, and I hung up. And I got in the car, and I drove over to Borders. It was 8 o'clock on a Sunday night, looking for a Big Book. Now, I don't know if you can imagine how funny it is walking into Borders and walking up to the clerk and saying, I'd like a big book. Because the first thing she asks you is, how big? And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never been to an AA meeting. Didn't know anything about this book. I didn't even know what the real name of it was. And I said, never mind. Because after all, I didn't want her to know I was alcoholic. I mean, why give it away? And the funny thing about that was, anyone who had ever met me, anyone who had ever knew me, anyone who had even bumped into me casually, they knew I was alcoholic. My friends all knew. My family all knew. My customers all knew. People who passed me by in the street all knew. But I didn't want this woman to know. It's so odd to me today. So I wandered around the store, and I got to the self-help section. They had the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm actually always amused by the fact that they put it in the self-help section. I didn't understand that then, but today, the entire premise of this book is that you can't help yourself. And it's in the self-help section. Whoever put it there never read this book. But they put it in the self-help section. This is not a self-help book, but I didn't understand that. So I got in the car and I started reading. Well, first I got up to the counter. And it wasn't one of these books, by the way. Thank God, because if this was the only one on the shelf, I don't think I'd have walked through the store with it. It was that plain blue leatherette one with no writing on it, and I thought I could get that past the clerk. Because if this was, I mean, I'd be walking through the store holding it under my arm trying to hide it. I didn't need the whole store to know I was alcoholic, and I hand it to the clerk, and she goes to ring it up, and it goes beep, beep. And now she looks down at it, and I'm looking at the register, and there's no numbers on there, and it says something like invalid, and she's beep, boop, and I'm thinking, oh God, this isn't good. Because, you know, I'm now figuring, price check on Alcoholics Anonymous, register one. And I don't need that. I'm pissed off enough. I don't need this. And I'm standing there just looking at her. And I guess she, like, realized what it was and wasn't going to make that announcement. So she put a little number in the back, and it rang up, and she charged me the $13.95 because they really get you over at Borders. And I got my car and I started to read it in the parking lot of Borders. God, is this book awful. Have you ever tried to read this book? It's awful. The language is like so archaic. I'll share this. You know, I started sponsoring these young kids eventually, and I never really realized how bad the language was until years later. I mean, I knew it was bad, but years later, I'm sitting in a car with this young kid. He's in his 20s, maybe 21. And we're reading the book for like an hour, and almost every sentence he'd say to me, what does that mean? And I'd explain it to him and read the next sentence. I don't understand. I'd explain it to him. Finally, he looks at me and goes, yo, dog, I'm mad tired. Can we go back to my crib and crash? And it occurred to me at that moment, had he written this book and had those people tried to get sober by reading it, it wouldn't have worked worth a darn. The language has certainly changed. It really changed. I mean, they talk about the gay crowd in the Mayflower Hotel. And the best as I can figure out, the Mayflower Hotel did not have a gay bar. But the language isn't quite what it used to be. So I get in the car and I start reading this book. And it's wordy. And the language is archaic. And my mind is racing so fast, I don't understand. I skip that whole, all the Roman numerals, because no self-respecting drunk reads any Roman numerals anyway. And then I start reading the stuff, and I figure I'll just go to the back of the book, see how it ends. And I get to the back of the book, and there's all these stories, and I don't like them any better than the rest of the book, so I go back to the front, I start reading. And I read all night. And by the end of the night, I'd read the 164 pages. It was 5 in the morning. 6 in the morning. 6 in the morning. I'd been up all night. I couldn't sleep anyway. And I called my brother down in Dallas at 6 a.m. And I says, well, I got that big book. He said, how was the meeting? I said, I didn't go to a meeting. I went to Borders. And he thought that was very funny. I didn't know why. It would seem to me if you wanted a book, you would go to Borders. And he said, what did you think? I said, well, it reminds me of this self-help program I did. Some 7 or 8 years earlier, I'd done one of those Tony Robbins Powerful Living So You Can Walk on Water and Be Everything programs. And it was a great program. One of those self-help late-night TV things, the big smile. It was a great program. It really was a very, very helpful program. It just didn't get me sober. And I said, it's just like that self-help program I did. And he said, well, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-help program. You might want to read that book again. And by the way, it's 5 a.m. in Dallas. Don't call me this early. And he hung up. Who knew? And I read it again and again, and I must have read it 2 or 3 more times, and now I'm just completely insane. You know, I'm picking out little one line here and one line there and trying to make it fit what I think it means, what it should say, because, you know. And He called me. I called him up, and I said, I just can't do this. He said, why don't you go to an AA meeting? I said, well. So I drove, and I sat in the parking lot the first day, and I watched people go in, and I thought, I'm not doing this. I left. And by the next day, I was just so out of my mind insane. I said, screw it, I'll go in. And I walked in. And there were real nice people in there. They sat me down, shook my hand, made me feel at home. Thank God. I don't know if I ever would have come back. And then some guy came to the front of the room, and he told this horrific story. He had been shot, beaten, stabbed, left for dead, covered in blood. He was in the back of a pickup truck. Oh, God, it went on. He had beaten up little children and stolen money from the nursing home. And, oh, just, I mean, awful story. And I'm sitting there as he tells this story thinking to myself, oh, God. Okay, I got that part. I already know how to do stupid things. I know how to get drunk. I know how to screw up my life. How do I get sober? Because I can't do this anymore. And this went on for like what seemed like forever. It was probably about 20 minutes. And right at the end, he says, after this awful war story, when then I stopped drinking and my life got wonderful, thank you. And they all clapped. And I went, how? How did you do that? He didn't tell me how. I thought, oh my God, he didn't tell me how. How do I do this? So then this woman, I see hands start to go up, and I think, oh, thank God, they're probably going to tell me how. And the first woman shared, and I've shared this 1,000 times, she told me how. She told me how she was parked at the mall in a handicapped spot. She was just going in to pay her bill, and she was only going to be 3 minutes, and they gave her a parking ticket. And for the next 5 or 6 or 10 minutes, however long it was, what she talked about was how she felt about her parking ticket. And I sat there going, oh, God, someone help me. How do I do this? And the next guy raised his hand. He was in a suit and tie. I thought, thank God, this guy looks like he's going to tell me how. He told me, and apparently, from what I understand today and from what I know him, he's been telling us this for 10 years, about this awful divorce that he was going through. And for the next 5 to 10 minutes, he told me how awful that woman was to him. And I'm sitting there thinking, how do I get sober? What do I do? And around the room they went, one after another, just complaining about their day. And I'm sitting thinking to myself, my God, I am never, ever, ever coming back here to listen to you people complain about your life. I'm not doing it. And they could see the look on my face. I didn't know they could see it, but they could see the look that I was never coming back. And the way I know that is because without asking, some little old lady leaned over to me and said, keep coming back. Because she knew I was never coming back. I said, and I looked at her and smiled, and I said, oh yeah, I'm thinking to myself the whole time, never, not in your life. I went home and I called my brother. He said, well, how was the meeting? And I said, all they did was complain about their life. Every one of them. He said, really? That doesn't sound like any AA meeting I've ever been to. I said, well, you want to come to New York? I said, maybe it's different in Dallas. He said, no. Why don't you just go to a different meeting? So I went to another meeting and there were lots more of that going on. And I say this is what I heard. And I want to be really honest about this. I don't have any idea what they were saying. Yeah. I don't have any idea what they were saying. I really don't know what they were saying. I know what I heard. What they were saying was probably different. Because the truth is, anytime anybody wanted to talk about this solution, I went like that. But I thought to myself, let me go back and try again. So I went back and I started listening. And then they gave me some suggestions. They told me to raise my hand and share because I would feel better. And then I wouldn't want to drink. And I thought, okay, I can do that. I can raise my hand and share so I feel better so I won't drink. So I started raising my hand and sharing with all of you. And what I shared with all of you was all the stupid things I did when I was drunk and all the awful things I was going through. Day after day, I'd come to meeting after meeting. And I'd tell you how awful my life was and what those people had done to me. And they patted me on the back and said, that's wonderful. Don't you feel better? And I always share, it's kind of like puking if you have a stomach virus. You know when you throw up and you feel better for about 15 minutes? And then you got to do it again. So I just go to another meeting. So I was going to 2 meetings because after all, they told me meeting makers make it, and I believed them. So I started going to 2 meetings a day because what the heck, 1's not enough. And then I started going to 3 because, well, 2's not enough. And then I was going to 4. And at every meeting, I'd do the same thing. I'd raise my hand and I'd share about my favorite subject, me, every problem, issue, and complaint I had. And I did this under the belief that if I just shared that with all of you, I would get sober. Well, I have to tell you, didn't quite work out that way. And I came to understand, for me, that was sort of delusional. Because you see, what I do when I feel better is I drink. When I don't feel good, I drink. When I have a good day, I drink. When I have a bad day, I drink. When I have a lot of money, I drink good stuff. When I have no money, I drink cheap stuff. When everything's going perfect in my life, I drink. And I'm under the delusion that if I just come here and share with all of you, I'll feel better and I won't want to drink. And it ain't working. Then they start giving me some other suggestions. They tell me to mop the floors, and so I'm doing that, complaining about it the whole time, thinking, I don't know what the hell I'm doing mopping these floors. And they tell me to put the chairs away, and I'm doing that. And they tell me to stay after, get there early, and I'm doing that. And not only am I complaining about my life in every meeting I go to, but everybody I can get a hold of in the parking lot, I would complain to them about my life. And some of them were very kind. They listened to me. And others told me to just shut up. And I walked away from those people. And after 4 months of this plan, I'm now going to 5 meetings a day. I'm going to the 6 o'clock meeting, 6 a.m., sunrise. I'm going to the 12 o'clock noon meeting. I'm going to the 5:30 happy hour meeting. I'm going to the 7:30 regular meeting. And I'm going to the midnight meeting over at the pit here in Bayshore, which if you've never been to, that's an experience you must not miss. And in every meeting, I raise my hand and I talk about myself. And now 4 months has gone by. I haven't had a drink. And I finally got into the next place it says in our big book.
How come
we
haven't had a drink?
What it says here is, I'm sorry, so we'll do questions later on, I suppose.
How come we haven't had a drink?
I'm sober by the grace of a power I call God. And it was a power I was asleep to. So down the bottom of the page, after it says that, what I talked about before, he's not happy about his sobriety. It says this, he cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he'll be able to imagine his life either with alcohol or without it. With or without it. That's where I'm without it, and I can't imagine my life. It says, then he will know a loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. For the end of what? He's not drinking. I can tell you, because after 4 months, I'm now driving from meeting to meeting, thinking about nothing but drinking, and now a thought comes to me, I should just kill myself. And I start to look for the fuse, for the airbag for my car, because I'm going to disconnect the fuse and I'm going to drive my car at 100 miles an hour into a tree. Because I don't want to be here anymore. The pain of being sober is so bad that I can't take it. Any of you ever been in that pain? I really thought to myself, I can't do this anymore. I can't do it anymore. I'm either going to drink or I'm going to kill myself. I left that meeting and I walked out and a man looked at my face and he said, what's wrong? I said, you know, I'm thinking about killing myself. And he said, well, you know what you need to do? I said, please, please tell me, what do I need to do? He said, you just need to go to more meetings. I said, my friend, I'm going to 4 and 5 meetings every day. He smiled. He said, I don't know what to tell you. Thank you. And the next day, God put this teacher in my life. He was a man I met online, because not only was I going to these 4 or 5 meetings a day, but I was going home and going to meetings online. That was always an experience. And I was typing to him, and I just typed to him in the room. I said, I think I'm going to kill myself. And he said, he popped up in an IM window, a little private message window, and he said, what's wrong? And I told him what was going on. And he gave me his phone number. He said, why don't you call me? He was out in Kansas. And I called him. And he said to me his name, and he said he was a recovered alcoholic. And I said, you're a what? He said, I'm a recovered alcoholic. Well, let me tell you, after 4 months of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew that couldn't be true. I knew he was always, you mean always recovering? He said, no, I'm a recovered alcoholic. I said, there's no such thing. He said, really? Who told you that? I said, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, the next person tells you that. Why don't you ask them where they got that from? Do you own a big book? I said, oh God, please. Don't tell me about that book. He said, do you own a big book? I said, yeah. He said, why don't you go get it? I'll help you understand it. Because I told him, I said, I don't understand that book. He said, go get it, I'll help you. And he asked me to open up to our title page and read to him what it said on the title page. It said, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And then he asked me this somewhat rhetorical question. He said, you think they meant recovered when they wrote it on the title page? I promptly answered him, I don't know. Because I had never heard that. He said, why don't you read the first sentence they wrote in the book? And he took me to the photo of the first edition, and he said, this is the first sentence they wrote. Read what it says. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous, more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. He said, do you think they meant recovered when they wrote it on the title page and when they wrote it as the first sentence of the book? I said, I don't know. So why don't you read me the next page? The next sentence, rather. It says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. He said, do you think they meant recovered when they wrote it on the title page, when they wrote it as the first sentence, and they wrote it as the second sentence? I said, you know, I'm beginning to think so. He said, well, they wrote it about 15 more times in this book. Never once did it suggest you'll always be recovering. So the next person tells you that, why don't you ask them where they got that from? Because it does not come from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me to a page where it explained to me in this book that our fellowship takes its name from this book, not the other way around. That we call ourselves Alcoholics Anonymous based on this book, and that this book contained our program, and that when someone were to tell me something, I should look in that book and see what that book says, because that book contained our program. He took me through it line by line, page by page. He asked me some tough questions. I remember one day telling me, turn to page 20.
Okay.
Read that first sentence. What's with this guy? Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon it. And he'd say, stop! Okay. So this says your very life depends on it. Why don't you read the rest of it? Are you doing that? Let's see. Our constant thought of others and how we might help meet their needs. He said, are you doing that? I said, no. He said, call me back when you are. Ooh. He took me line by line through it. And he helped explain to me what it meant to be alcoholic. I didn't understand. I didn't understand that nothing I knew would ever keep me from drinking. See, I knew I shouldn't drink. And that never stopped me. When they told me, just don't take the first drink and you won't get drunk, my thought about that was, no kidding. Like, that was not an epiphany for me. I knew if I didn't take the first drink, I wouldn't get drunk. What I didn't know is, how do I not take the first drink? He explained to me that I suffered from the same failure. He took it right out of our book, of the kind of defense that keeps you from putting your hand on a hot stove. When we got to that line, I think it was the first time in my life I ever realized what was really wrong with me. Because he made me think about it. He said, they describe alcoholism here as the complete failure of the same defense that keeps you from putting your hand on your hot stove. What is it that keeps you from putting your hand on a hot stove? And so I immediately said, pain. He said, oh, no, no. You won't experience pain until you touch the stove. What keeps you from touching the stove? Well, he was right. It wasn't pain because I wouldn't feel pain until I touched it. What was it? Well, it was knowing that it would burn me or remembering that it would burn me. And he said, right, alcoholism is the failure of those two defenses. And as I look back on my life, I could see absolutely clearly that that was the truth. I could see for the first time in my life that nothing I knew and nothing I remembered would keep me from drinking. And I felt sick to my stomach. I said to him, I'm screwed. Actually, I used another word. I said, I'm just screwed. He said, well, the word we prefer is powerless. It looks a lot better on the shades in front of the room. He said, but I think you maybe you're starting to understand what powerless really means. Powerless doesn't mean once you put it in you, does it? I said, no. He said, powerless means whether you're going to drink or not. And I said, that's right. I'm powerless over whether I can drink or not, whether I'll drink or not, because even if I say I won't, I will. Even if I know I shouldn't, I do. And even though I've had awful experiences where the memory of those experiences should keep me from drinking, they don't. And I realized for the first time in my life what it truly meant to be powerless. And I thought, wow, that's a little different than what I believed, because I believed as long as I didn't take the first one, I was okay. And now I realize that I didn't have the power to not take the first one in the first place. Then we talked about unmanageable, and at this point it was when he told me that if I thought alcohol was my problem, I would probably die a drunk. And I thought that was utterly ridiculous. I said, of course alcohol is my problem. He said, really? He said, well, if you believe that, you'll probably die a drunk. And I thought that was insane. I said, well, if alcohol is not my problem, what is? He said, well, why don't you think about that for a minute? And he asked me to consider my own life. He asked me to consider how I felt when I was sober. And I realized in that moment that the reason I drank was because I couldn't stand my life the way it was. And that what I really suffered from was an awful sobriety problem. that I couldn't stand the pain of being sober. And the longer I was sober, the worse that pain got. And then how I treated my bad sobriety problem was to drink. And now I could see why, if he said that if I thought alcohol was my problem, see, if alcohol was my problem, I would have a simple solution. Just don't drink. But my sobriety problem gets worse when I do that. I didn't understand that. He helped me see that truth. So, coupled with those two, we started to talk about God. And at this point, I came in, I tell you this, I didn't want to talk to anybody. God, are you kidding me? I don't want anything to do with God. And he asked me if I'd just keep an open mind. And he started to have conversations with me about this power that I would find within myself. See, I was looking in the wrong place. He told me a Santa Claus story I like to share. Any young children in the room? Okay. So he said, he asked me if I believed in Santa Claus when I was a child. I said, of course I did. And he asked me if there came a time when I didn't believe that anymore. I said, yeah, they did. And he asked me if I believed there was one now, and I said, no. And then he said, can you describe what he looks like? I said, sure, red outfit, white beard, black belt. He said, okay. He said, let me ask you another question. Do you believe that there is a power called Santa Claus? I said, I don't think so. He said, really? You must come with me to Toys R Us in November. You will see lots of evidence of a power called Santa Claus. He said, you'll see people taking selfless actions and giving gifts in an anonymous name. He said, that's a pretty powerful force, isn't it? I said, oh yeah. He said, if you go to the North Pole, will you find that there? I said, no. He said, where will you find it? I said, in the human heart. He said, that's where you should start looking for God. Then he told me about love. He asked me if I believed there was a power called love. I said, yes, I'd experienced it. He said, tell me how you act when the power called love is present in your life. He said, are you selfless? I said, pretty much. He said, do you have to think about how to behave when love is present? I said, absolutely not. Is it intuitive? I said, yeah. He said, so will you take selfless actions? Will you may even risk your own life when love is present? I said, absolutely. He said, that's a pretty powerful force, isn't it? I said, yes. He said, can you smell love? I said, no. Can you see it? No. Can you touch it? Can you taste it? I said, no. He said, it's real though, isn't it? I said, absolutely. He said, interestingly enough, he told me you were a Christian. He said, in Christian scripture, it says God is love. It doesn't say God's like love, it is love. And it's a power that changes something inside of me that causes me to take actions I would never otherwise take. He said, just like love. He said, so if you can believe in love, I'll bet you can believe in God. I could go with that. The next day we did a third step prayer. Made a decision. He took me to Bill's story. And he asked me these series of questions at one point. Bill's story, it says what Bill did exactly. It says this, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. He said, have you done that? I said, no. He said, I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. Have you done that? I said, no. He said that he admitted for the first time that of himself he was lost. Without God he was nothing. Have you done that? I said, no. He said, I ruthlessly faced my sins and been willing to have my newfound friend God, take him away root and branch. Have you done that? I said, no. So what exactly have you done? So I go to meetings every day and I raise my hand and I share about myself. He said, is that what Bill Wilson did? I said, no. He said, then why do you think that'll work for you? Pretty strong language from him. But he didn't write the book either. So we did this third step prayer. And when we were done, he said, take out a piece of paper. I said, what for? He said, we're going to start writing a fourth step. I said, today? I said, shouldn't I wait a year on that? He said, let's read the directions. And the directions give us two time periods. One says next, and the next one says at once. He said, which one would you like to choose? Well, I guess we'll go with next. He said, good. And he asked me to start making a list of people I was resentful at. And in the middle of that list, God, that list went on forever. God, could I write? And I started writing all the names down. And I was done with those names. I went back. He had me starting writing down what all these people had done to me. And he said, put it all down there. Get every detail. And in the middle of that four-step somewhere, I'm sitting at home. And I'm watching TV and I'm going through the channels like, you know, if you ever, when you're a little restless, irritable, and discontented, or unhappy, pissed off, cranky, angry, like our big book describes you might be, suffering from untreated alcoholism, I'm changing the channels a million miles an hour. I've got the phone over here. I've got the laptop over here and the newspaper on my lap, and I'm doing them all at once because I need to keep busy. And the TV stops on a Geico commercial. And I look at the number and I think, I should call and get cheaper car insurance. I mean, I got nothing else to do. And I dial the number for the Geico and I give them my information, and I was married at the time, and I give him my wife. I says, let me call you. She says, I need your wife's driver's license number, but give me her date of birth and any accidents, tickets. I said, no. He said, good. He said, gives me a quote, and I think, wow, I can save, you know, like the commercial, I can save $600. And I hang out. He goes, well, I need her driver's license number so I can get you going. I said, great. So I called her. She was over in the mall shopping, and I asked her for a driver's license number. And I called Geico back and gave the guy a driver's license number, and he said, oh, I'm sorry. We can't give you car insurance. I said, what do you mean? He said, your wife's license is suspended. I said, she's what? Her license is suspended. I said, wait a minute, you don't know my wife. She's never gotten a ticket, ever. No, her license is just, hold on. He looks, he's clicking, hear him clicking away. He goes, yeah, she got a ticket in January for driving with a cell phone without a headset, and she never paid it. And I was berserk. I call her back in the mall, and man, do I have a resentment going on. I am screaming. I am yelling. I am swearing. She hangs up on me. She calls me back and says, you know, I just want, and I won't even let her talk. I'm screaming and yelling, I can't believe you did this. She hangs up on me. I call her back. How do you hang up on me? I can't believe you didn't tell me you got this ticket. She hangs up, and now I'm sitting there. I'm like in a total, like, meltdown. And I call this guy out in Kansas. I said, what do I do? He said, well, as long as we're doing your inventory, let's write that one out. Column one. I put down her name. Column two, I write down about this ticket and that. Column three, affects your self-esteem. Oh, absolutely. How I feel about myself, I don't feel good about myself now at all. I can't get car insurance. My pride, yeah, what if other people know? I feel awful. My personal relations, well, probably, some way, I guess. My sex relations, oh yeah, that's out the window, forget that. My security, my ambitions, it affected just about every area of my life, and he asked me how and why. When I was done with that, he said, oh good, we got the easy part out of the way. He said, putting out of mind the wrongs that others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. And he said, what's your part in all this? What did you do wrong? I said, what did I do? You don't understand, that woman got a ticket and didn't tell me. Whoa, did you not write that all in column two? If you missed anything, go put it in there. So I said, no, I got that all. He said, all right, so what's your part? What did I do? You don't understand. This woman got a ticket. He said, you got that already. That's column two. Where are your mistakes? So what are my mistakes? You got to be kidding me. How do I have any mistakes with this? He asked me a question which changed my whole life. He said, how long are you married? I said, 16 years. He said, who have you been for 16 years that woman could get a ticket and be afraid to tell you? I went, ooh. He said, why don't you write that stuff down in your fourth column? By the time I was done with my inventory, I could see who I had been. Not just to her, but to a lot of people. I started noticing things. Like, I would come home from work, and she would say, I bought steaks, some steaks tonight. And I'd say, what kind of steaks did you buy? And she'd say, the kind you told me to buy? I thought, what kind of an answer is that? That's an answer from a woman who's scared to death of you. I could see that truth in a heartbeat, and I'd apologize for those things. I'd say, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry that you're so afraid of me for the things I've done. And I stopped being that man. But by the time I was done with my fifth step with him, I could see my life was a mess. Man, I could not. When I looked at that life, I could not believe not only who I had been, but my next thought was, I don't know how to be anyone else. I can't fix this. This is who I am, and I don't know how to change this. Because I can tell you, I won't do that again. But I'll do it again. And he said, good, let's start step 6 and 7. He said, you see, you can't fix this. If you could fix this, you would. He led me to believe that I always did the best I could with the light I had to see by. My problem was I didn't have so much light. He said, this was a process of turning the lights up so I could see a little better. Because as I saw better, I wouldn't make those mistakes. As God gave me power, those mistakes wouldn't happen. I started to understand a little more about love at that moment. Because what I realized was that when love was present in my life, I didn't really exhibit character defects. Now, I'm not talking about lust. I exhibit a lot of character defects when love is present. When love is present, I'm not selfish. I'm not dishonest. I'm not afraid. And that as I came to experience the power called God in step 6 and 7, I started to realize that it wasn't me that was going to fix my character defects. This power, just like love, would change my heart, would change my actions, would change how I saw the world. And so it did. Sometimes I was in a meeting the other night, it was a 7-step meeting, and the guy said, I asked God to help me remove my character defects. See, my experience is so different from that. God doesn't help me remove my character defects. It's not what it says in step 6. First, I told Marvin, when he called me up a couple of days later after he told me to read what it said, he said, "How's it going?" I said, "Oh, I'm working on my character defects." He laughed. He said, "You're working on them?" I said, "Yeah, I'm working on them." He said, "And how's that working out for you?" "Oh, it's not. They don't seem to be going anywhere." He said, "Where did you get the idea that you were going to work on them?" I don't know. Today I understand it's not me that removes those character defects. But when I get present to this power I call love or God, I don't do those things. I'm not selfish, not dishonest, and I'm not afraid. I don't manipulate. Then we got to my amends. Make that list. There were a lot of people I wasn't putting on that list. And I said, "I can't possibly make these amends. I can't make these amends." And he said the same dumb thing to me again. He said, "Of course you can't. Not in your power." He said, "I bet you God can, through you. Why don't you let God's power in?" And so I started making those amends, the ones I could think of, and there were people I was never going to see, and people I never even thought of making amends to. And God's got a funny sense of humor in that way. I started sponsoring this guy a little while later on, and he got a flat tire one day by this gas station up in Kings Park, about 15 minutes from my house, and I drove over by his car, and we jacked it up and got the tire off. We drove over to the gas station. As I pulled up to this gas station, I looked, and I remembered I'd worked there when I was 17. I remember when I left, it was a Friday night, and I left a note: "I'm not coming in tomorrow morning to open." That was all it was. I slid the key through the envelope, the little mail drop. I took my money out of the drawer for the night. "I'm not coming back." So now here I am in this gas station 20-something years later. And the guy that owned it was probably in his late 60s, and I'm thinking, no way he's here, thank God. I want to see him again. And I walk in, and there's his son, who at this point is in his 50s. And we're changing the tire, and I said, "Did Eddie used to own this gas station? Eddie P?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm his son." I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "I used to work here," kind of smiling. He said, "I know. I only worked there for like 3 months. I couldn't even believe he remembered me from 20-something years ago." And he says, "You know how come I remember?" He said, "You see, the day you left, that Saturday was my daughter's communion. And I couldn't be there because I had to come open the gas station." I said, "Oh, my God." I said, "Eddie, I am so sorry. I am so sorry I did that to you." He said, "That's okay." I said, "You know, I explained a little about my life and what had happened and where I was now. And I said, if there's anything I can do to make it right..." He said, "Just don't ever do that to anybody else." He said, "You seem like you've changed." God's funny like that. My amends lot went like that. Some of the times when I'd ask people that awful question, "Was there anything else I did to harm you that I haven't talked about?" Man, what they tell you. It's probably the best question I can ask. Because see, what I think I did to harm them usually isn't what I did to harm them. So I made some of those amends, and then I had these big financial amends. Someone told me there was the exemption in here, the IRS exemption, in the big book on page 316 or something. Have you ever read about the IRS exemption? Apparently there's no IRS exemption, because somewhere in this new conscience that began to form as I experienced this, I realized that I had to go take care of some business with the IRS. And it was a lot of money, tens of thousands of dollars. And I thought, my God, I'll never pay those people back. And then there was the state of New York, another tens of thousands of dollars. And I looked at that pile of money and I thought, my God, I'll never pay that back. And I called up I called this guy who was taking me through the steps, and I said, "What am I going to do about this?" And he said, "You're not going to pay it with your money anyway." I said, "I'm not." He said, "You don't have any money." I said, "What do you mean?" took me to that line in Bill's story. I hate the way he worked with this book. It's a line that said, simple but not easy, a price had to be paid. It meant the destruction of self-centeredness. And the next line is the one. It said, I must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all. And he asked me what they thought I meant when it said all things. And I said, everything, I guess. My problems, right? He said, I don't think God wants your problems. He said, I think he wants all things. He said, do you have any money? I said, a little bit. He said, do you own a home? I said, yeah. He said, do you have a car? I said, yeah. He said, whose money is it? I said, it's my money. He said, whose house is it? I said, it's my house. He said, whose car is it? I said, it's my car. He said, let's read that again. We must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all. I said, are you suggesting it's God's house, God's money, and God's car? He said, yeah. That sounds pretty drastic. He said, oh, read the next line. He said, these were revolutionary and drastic proposals. He said, I guess you heard me all right. So, he said, it's not your money anyway. Don't worry about it. God will give you the power to pay back what you're supposed to pay back. And gratefully, he has. I made the last payment to the state a month ago, after 4 years. Those people are gone. Another 8 or 9 months, the federal government will be paid off. And I'll have paid back a sum of money that I never thought was possible. I take no credit for that. I didn't do it on my power. On my power, those people were never getting a dime. I did that on the power of God. Started sharing about this stuff in meetings. All of a sudden, these same people would see me day after day at 2 or 3. They saw me at every meeting in town because I was going to so many. 6 weeks later, they hear me start to share at meetings. And they don't understand what's happened to me. I remember I came home on that Saturday. That Saturday after I did that tire thing, and I sat down on my couch. I've been out making that amends to that guy. And I sat down on the couch and I realized that for the first time in my life, I did not want to drink. For the first time in my life, that screaming that was my brain had gotten silent. For the first time in my life, it was okay for me to be me sober. I had never experienced that my whole life. I'd never experienced feeling okay sober. I remember calling up this guy and saying, something happened. He said, what's that? I said, I don't know. I can't really explain it. It's like somebody turned my brain off. It's like I stopped thinking or something. It's like it just got silent. And like, I don't want to drink. And it's okay for me to be me for the first time ever. And he said, quick, turn to Bill's story. What's with you? And there was a line in Bill's story. He said, for I was alarmed. And I called my friend the doctor to ask if I was still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. And he asked me this question. He said, what the hell do you think Bill Wilson was alarmed about? I said, you know, I never really thought about it. He said, you see, the same thing happened to him that just happened to you. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never thought about it. What was Bill alarmed about? He was alarmed about experiencing a sense of peace and ease and comfort and serenity that he had never known. The utter confidence. That's what he was alarmed about. And that's what had happened to me. And it was alarming. But I go back to these meetings and I start to share. And all of a sudden, I'm no longer sharing about my issues, my problems, my complaints. I'm sharing about this power called God and what it's done in my life. I'm telling people about my experiences and how it's changed my life. And I'm only like 6 months sober, and I've only been working with this guy about 6 weeks. And people start coming up to me and they ask me, will you sponsor me? I said, oh no, I can't. I'm not sober a year. And I went home and called this guy and I said, you're not going to believe what's happening. People are starting to ask me to sponsor them. He said, good, sponsor them. I said, sponsor them? How can I sponsor them? I don't have a year. He said, did you not understand a word of what we read in that book? What page does it say you're supposed to be sober a year? I said, well, I don't remember. He said, it doesn't say it. It's not in there. There is a criteria. Our 12th step tells you what it is. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we're supposed to carry this message. He said, have you had one? I said, oh yeah. He said, then go carry this message. I said, what do I do with this guy? He said, just do with him what I did with you. Tell him the truth. So I started sponsoring that guy. I didn't tell him the truth. It was much too difficult. I didn't want to scare him away. I didn't want him to not like me. So I lied to him a little. I told him, just don't drink. Go to meetings. Meeting makers make it. Keep coming back. You'll be okay. One day at a time. Keep it simple. I told them all to him. And it was all okay for a while. And then 2 days before my first anniversary, His wife walked into the morning meeting. She was also in our fellowship. Tears in her eyes. She looked like she'd been crying all night. And I said, "My God, what's wrong?" She said, "My husband's in the hospital. He took a bottle of pills and a bottle of vodka. His heart stopped and he's brain dead. We're probably going to have to unplug him today." I went, "My God." And then my first thought, of course, "I hope she doesn't know I'm sponsoring him." She didn't say a word. I went home and I called this guy and I said, "You sick son of a bitch, you told me to sponsor that guy." He said, "Whoa, slow down, what's wrong?" I said, "What's wrong? He's over in the hospital, we're going to have to unplug him, he's going to die." And he said, "That's between him and God, that's not between you and him." He said, "But let me ask you a question." He said, "I'm really grateful that happened to you." I said, "You're grateful? You sick son of a bitch." He said, no, whether he dies or not, between him and God, that's not your business. He said, "But I'm grateful that you got to experience that." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Well, let me ask you some questions." He said, "First thing I want to know is, did you tell that man the same truth I told you?" I said, "No." He said, "Why not?" I said, "I was afraid I'd scare him away." He said, "Well, the next time somebody asks you, you can tell them the truth. Or you can lie to them and watch them die right in front of you. The choice is yours." Made me pretty passionate about this. I've never lied to anybody again. He told me what would happen next is that I'd become very unpopular in some meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous. I told him that was ridiculous. He said, "No, people are going to get mad at you." I said, "For what?" He said, "You'll see." A couple of weeks later, I called him and said, "You know, these people hate me." He said, "Yeah, I'll bet." He said, "Just keep it in the eye." He said, "They'll hate you a little less." He said, "But they'll hate you." I said, "Why do they hate me?" He said, "I don't know, but remember this, they hated me first." I knew where that came from. That came from that bigger big book. He took me to that bigger big book a lot after that. He said, "Remember, if they hate you, they hated me first." And then he said, "They will hate you because of me." I understand what that means today. Alcoholics Anonymous is a really funny place. If I come in and I say I've made this chair my God, everybody's cool with it. If I tell you I made that light bulb my God, everybody's happy about it. If I tell you I made my sponsor, the hairy old guy in the corner, my God, everybody's good with that. If I tell you I made this group my God, everybody's good with that. If I tell you I made Jesus my God, they freak out. I can't figure that part out. Why would that be? This book begs us to lay aside our prejudice even against organized religion. Begs us. Doesn't even beg you not to drink. Matter of fact, it says go ahead if you want to. It really doesn't. But it begs you to lay aside your prejudice against organized religion. I don't understand that. I do today. Sponsored a bunch of people after that. I've gotten to witness, as a result of this 12 steps, some amazing miracles. I've got to see wives and mothers of the people I sponsor with tears in their eyes, tears of joy, as they come to a first anniversary. And their husband or son is so totally changed that they don't even recognize them. They've got their family back. I got to sit in a church next to a man doing a third step and have the most profound experience I ever had in my life. We went to this church. I don't know, are we going to run over, does it matter? Went to this church. I would try and finish up soon. Went to this church and with this guy, and it was a newcomer I was working with. I met him over in a detox. And we're driving from meeting to meeting from place to place and looking for this church. He wanted to do his third step prayer with me in the church he got married in, and we couldn't find it. Just like an alcoholic. Can't find the church he got married in. And we're driving from place to place. Turn left up there. I think it's down this block. And finally, now 20, 30 minutes, and this guy is getting so upset. And for whatever reason, I just kept saying to him, "It's okay. This is exactly the way it's supposed to be." We walked into that church 20 minutes late. And it's one of those double door situations. You come in these first doors and these two glass doors looking in at the church. And he sees in the church, up in the front of the church, was a bunch of little kids, second graders, getting ready to make their communion. And they were having a little catechism class up there. He goes, "Oh, now we can't go in as people." I said, "We're just going to go in the back of the church and kneel down." So we knelt down in the silence. And I'm waiting for it to get silent. And he goes, "Ready yet?" I said, no, let's just be silent for a minute. And I hear the teacher say to these little kids, "So what is it God doesn't want you to do?" Now, before I tell you a little more, this guy was an alcoholic. He then became a heroin junkie. And then he relapsed, taking oxycodone. from his doctor. So the first little hand goes up, what doesn't God want you to do? And the little kid says, God doesn't want you to drink alcohol. And I'm sitting there in the silence thinking, yes! And I start to realize I can feel him looking at the side of my head. I can only imagine, I'm sitting going, yes. And then the next little kid raises their hand and says, God doesn't want you to take drugs. And I'm like, these are like fifth graders. Who would come up with this? These are little kids. I'm thinking, yes. And the third one blew me away. This little kid raised her hand, she was kind of stuttering, and she said, well, sometimes when people go to the doctor gives them medicine, it makes them sick, and they keep taking it. Now I feel this guy just burn his way right through, and I'm like this, I look over him, he's like this, his eyes bugging out of his head. I said, are you ready to do that third step prayer yet? He said, yeah, I am. We did that third step prayer, we walked out of the church, he was white as a ghost. He said, what the hell just happened in there? I said, that, my friend, is the grace of God in your life. Don't you ever forget that. I said, but I'll tell you something else. I don't believe that God did that for you. He said, what do you mean? He got kind of offended. I said, you know, as you started to understand this program, as we went through Bill's story, you started to say, well, I don't have a message to carry. What should I say in a meeting then? I said, why don't you go bear witness to God's power at the next AA meeting you go to? Why don't you go tell them about the profound experience you just had? He said, they won't believe me. I said, that's where the test of faith comes in. Share it anyway. So you now have a message to carry. I really believed, 4 months into this deal, before I met this man, that our 12 steps said, having figured out some crazy way to not drink as a result of going to a lot of AA meetings, mopping the floors, stacking the chairs, and making the coffee, we tried to carry this message to others. That's not what it says. Today, I understand that as the result of these 12 steps, I've had a profound spiritual awakening. It has changed the way I see the world. And I've got the privilege of being able to watch God as I carry this message, to watch God change the lives of other people. I take no credit for it. Guys I sponsor all that, they'll say, thank you. I'll say, don't thank me, thank God when you get in bed tonight. Because I have nothing to do with this. Left on my power, I'd be home right now drunk watching Jerry Springer reruns. That's who I am. On God's power, something a little different happens in my life. So if you're new here tonight, if you're just coming around, if you've been one of those guys who's in and out, men or women who's in and out 15 or 20 times, if you've never done these 12 steps, great. Because that means there's hope. And if you've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time and managed to stay away from alcohol, but you're struggling and every day is a struggle. Because I thought that's what it was going to be. Just going to hang on one more stupid day at a time. I didn't have one more stupid day left. When you get to that place, know that there's a real solution. It's in these 12 steps. And as you experience what I've experienced, you'll see the world differently. Now, I am not perfect. Let me tell you, I screw up every day. Our 10th step promises us that we'll screw up. It really does. Says when these, we would continue to watch for resentment, dishonesty, fear, selfishness. When these crop up, it doesn't say if, it says when. I have some place to go so I can get back connected to that power, which will keep me from taking another drink. So if you're new, if you've never done this, or if you're coming around for a long time and you've never done this and you're struggling, know that there's a real answer here. And that this answer, so it was a path for me to God, and the power called God keeps me sober. It's just that simple. I don't keep myself sober. It's the very first thing I said, and it's the last thing I'll say. Thank you.